Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to the Words on Flick show on eWater Radio, KEWRDB. Welcome, welcome. Thanks for joining us at the Words on Flick show, movie talk from a fan perspective with me, entertainment journalist, blogger, and movie fan, Janine Coveney, and wishing you a continued happy Black History Month. Thanks again for tuning in. As you may know, or not, I grew up in the Bronx during the 1960s and 70s, a time of great turbulence in New York City economically, and books and movies were my escape from a city where we had gas rationing and sanitation strikes and subway strikes and burnt out buildings in the South Bronx, crime, all kinds of things going on in New York City. So it was during this time that undergoing an upheaval, starting in the late 60s, as the major studio system was starting to lose money and audiences for their kind of, big studio movies with big budgets and big stars and stories that were less and less a reality for people existing across the country at that time. So a whole new generation of independent filmmakers were making their way into the industry, making their mark by raising money independently, using a grittier style, and telling more personal and more counterculture kinds of stories on film. And these low-budget films were connecting with their audiences at a time when movie theaters were also starting to lose money for their owners, and so distributors were putting films in, pulling audiences in. So this created a great atmosphere to launch a whole new generation of directors, actors, screenwriters. And so this is the time also that exploitation films were born, and particularly its urban version, Blaxploitation. So personally, some of these films I saw when they were first released, but I was pretty young, and so sometimes I was barred from seeing them. They were inappropriate to my age, or I couldn't sneak away and get to the theater and see some of these more adult, violent kinds of films. So a lot of them I've seen since becoming an adult, and because they are steeped in that time period and eye-opening their storytelling and themes, they've become part of our cinema lexicon and part of our history. They're cultural touchstones for us. And as I say, they launched and killed more than a few careers. So this week, I wanted to continue my celebration of classic Black films in a chat with a very, very special guest, respected entertainment scribe, Mr. Michael A. Gonzalez. Let me tell you something. This man knows his stuff. He's been writing about music, primarily hip-hop, film, and now he writes a lot about books by early African-American authors, lost books. So as I say, he knows his stuff. So here's like the formal bio. Michael A. Gonzalez has written essays and articles for The Village Voice, New York, Pitchfork, and Mass Appeal. He's the co-author of Bring the Noise, A Guide to Rap Music and Hip-Hop Culture from 1991. And he's also written a lot of music pieces for Vibe, The Source, Essence, Ebony, and Wax Poetics. His short fiction has appeared in Bronx Biannual, Brown Sugar, Black Pulp, and The Root. And like many of us writers, he's finishing a novel, his literary New York City hip-hop novel, Boom for Real, is coming soon. And he also writes for The Blacklist, so that can be found on Facebook. So I would like to welcome Mr. Michael A. Gonzalez. What's up, my brother?
Hello, Janine. How are you?
I'm doing great.
That was a great introduction. Thank you.
Oh, you're absolutely welcome. I could introduce, you know, so much more because you've accomplished so much in all these years. And, I mean, you're prolific. You're a pretty prolific writer, I have to say.
Well, you know, I've been writing since I was a small child, and you know, I got my first typewriter when I was 8 years old, and I think that's when I decided I wanted to be a writer. And, you know, I was just blessed. I had very good mentors and, you know, people who basically, you know, gave me the discipline or helped me with the, you know, encouraging me to have the discipline to sit down to write and to, you know, knock these pieces out. So, you know, that's kind of all I really do right now is write these pieces. So I'm kind of blessed in that sense.
Absolutely. And we're blessed by reading because, you know, you really go deep into subjects and connect the dots so that we understand the cultural significance of what it is that you're writing about and the history of it. But I want to get right to our topic of the evening, which is Blaxploitation, which you've written about extensively. And so the Wikipedia, okay, so Wikipedia definition of Blaxploitation is that it's an ethnic subgenre of the exploitation film that emerged in the United States during the early 70s. And these films, though receiving backlash for stereotypical characters, are among the first in which Black characters and communities are the heroes and subjects of film and television rather than sidekicks or villains or victims of brutality. So would you agree with that definition of Blaxploitation, or is there an alternate definition that we should accept?
Well, I think I agree with that explanation to a degree. I remember interviewing Fred Williamson, who's one of my favorite Blaxploitation stars, many years ago when his movie Original Gangsters was coming out. And when I said the word Blaxploitation, he got very upset and kind of schooled me on the fact that, you know, a lot of these movies were basically just Black gangster movies in the same way that Bogart made Black gangster movies or Cagney made, made gangster movies. Jimmy Cagney made gangster movies. I mean, you know, gangster films have been the foundation of American cinema probably since the beginning. You know, movies like Underworld and Scarface and, you know, Howard Hawks and Ben Heck and these guys who came out of this tradition. And, you know, when you look at a film like Hell Up in Harlem or Black Caesar, you see that Fred Williamson is kind of channeling those same kind of villains, those same kind of godfather figures. You know, when I was growing up and watching these movies, I don't recall them being called Blaxploitation movies. You know, that nobody really was using that term at the time. That was a term I didn't even realize existed probably until 10 years after the, you know, those movies were gone. So, I mean, I like the word because I like words that kind of describe certain things. But, of course, the genre, as far as I'm concerned, is vast and, you know, goes beyond what Wikipedia might say.
I feel you. But I know that so many people say that because it's us, you know, African Americans being depicted on screen, we're sensitive to being stereotyped always and how we're represented. And so there's the warring faction of how we want to see ourselves and how we are. So, you know, so many of these movies do depict violence, dysfunction, crime, poverty, drug abuse, sex work, etc. But at the same time, there are heroes and people who survive and rise above it. And in that sense, they are mirroring movies that have been made for decades in Hollywood.
Well, even the movies that were made in the 70s, I mean, like you were saying before, the films started changing from the late 60s and early 70s. The industry was changing completely. I mean, look at films from the 60s, and, you know, you have The Sound of Music's and The King and I, and those kind of movies were going out of style. The studios weren't making them anymore. Certain studios were almost bankrupt at that point. MGM was almost going out of business. But, you know, the movies, even the white movies started becoming a little bit more graphic, a little bit more violent. I mean, you know, you talk about not seeing certain films when you were a kid. Unfortunately, I saw everything. So I remember seeing The French Connection. And a film like The French Connection, a film like The Godfather, a film like The Velocity Papers, I mean, you know, all these films were coming out during that same era. They kind of paralleled the black movies, the so-called blaxploitation movies of that era. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting to me. The guy who created Shaft was a white writer named Ernest Tigerman. And Ernest Tigerman wrote the screenplay for The French Connection, which came out the same year that the Shaft movie came out. So the same year that Isaac Hayes won an Oscar for Shaft, the guy who created Shaft won an Oscar for The French Connection.
Wow.
I mean, these films were overlapping each other. And I guess, you know, I mean, black people might have wanted to see more positive images. But at the same time, I think those movies, I mean, I don't even know what to say in terms of the positive imagery. I mean, some of them were just, you know, good movies. But they were good gangster movies, good cop and robber movies. I mean, you look at a movie like Across 110th Street, these movies, some of them, they still stand up 40, 50 years later.
Mm-hmm. But some of them don't stand up well. You know, while they may have had interesting stories, you know, the pacing was poor, the lighting wasn't always the best. You know, some of them had problems, but we loved them anyway because, you know, it was reflecting a reality that we could identify with. We were seeing actors and actresses on the screen that looked like us. So, you know, because not all those movies.
Well, you
know,
I find it kind of interesting because I know certain movies, like the Rudy Ray Moore movies, like those movies were so bad, I guess they were brilliant. I mean, right now, Eddie Murphy is making the Rudy Ray Moore story for Netflix, which is something that I'm interested in seeing, because if you look at those Rudy Ray Moore movies, I mean, sometimes you can see microphones hanging into the shot, or sometimes you can, I mean, like, it's just, some of it is so bad, you're almost like, did they do this intentionally? Like, was it supposed to be this bad? I mean, but then there's other ones that, you know, like, I guess, like a movie like Superfly, which is one of my favorite movies. To me, I mean, when I watched the remake of Superfly last year, I couldn't even understand why they bothered, because, you know, I mean, I guess kids don't want to go back and watch a 50-year-old movie, but to me, a film like Superfly still stands up. A film like Shaft still stands up. I mean, there's a lot of movies from that era, white and black, that may not stand up. And some films from that era that have been called masterpieces, that, and myself, I'm like, really? Like, you know, like when I watch Easy Rider, I mean, I like it, but is it really a masterpiece?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
I don't think it's a masterpiece, but people look at it that way because it represented counterculture. It was a breakthrough for how films and characters were represented, and it was an independent film, so people just, you know, it spoke to the zeitgeist of the time of, you know, anti-establishmentarianism. So I think people call it a masterpiece because of that, but does that mean that it is a great example of movie making craft? Not, no.
Well, you know, I mean, there are certain movies. I remember I didn't see Sweetback when it came out because Sweetback was probably the only black film of that era that was actually rated X.
It was
so
X-rated, yeah.
I didn't see Sweetback until I was an adult. And when I watched Sweetback, you know, after hearing for years about the genius of Sweetback, I was like, are we serious right now? Like, I didn't get it at all. I mean, it was amusing, but I didn't see it as this great film that everybody had been talking about for years. Now, you know, I realized that if I had seen it at the time, if I had been an adult in the 70s and saw it at the Apollo, or, you know, maybe I would have had a different reaction to it. But seeing it as an adult 20 years after it was released, I was just kind of like, you know, if I don't know, I just didn't get it. And I love Melvin Van Peebles, but I did not get that movie at all.
I understand, but I have actually never seen it. I've had opportunities over the years to see it, and somehow I missed. And that seems to be an admission as bad as people saying that they've never seen The Godfather or something in some circles, but
well,
that's
tell
okay.
Okay, when I saw it, when I finally got a chance to see it, I think I was in my early 20s, and I just dismissed it. And then I saw it years later, knowing more, a little bit more about Melvin, knowing that he had lived in Paris. And, you know, Melvin was actually living in Paris when the French New Wave cinema was going strong. So, you know, so mm-hmm. he was living in Paris when Godard and Truffaut and, you know, these young Turks, you know, these Parisians who were doing these cutting-edge films were doing their thing. So when I saw Sweetback again later on, I kind of processed it through that aesthetic, and mm-hmm. I was kind of wondering if Melvin was influenced by what the French New Wave guys were doing in terms of handheld cameras and that kind of thing, and, you know, this kind of on the run but not really running anywhere kind of thing, like, you know, constantly in motion kind of thing, just how the scenes were edited together, all of that stuff kind of felt like it was influenced by what Godard was doing. Not so much Truffaut, because Truffaut seemed like he came from a more straightforward perspective in terms of making films. But, you know, when you watch some of the Godard films, you either love them or hate them, you know. And I felt
mm-hmm.
like Melvin might have been
Breathless.
Influenced by some of that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's talk about because you made the remark earlier that blaxploitation is casts a wider net than some of the strict definitions of what the genre entails, and that's what I wanted us to talk about a little bit. And I know you wanted to talk about movies that were made during this era and kind of they're classified under blaxploitation banner, but are really maybe more social dramas or comedies
mm-hmm.
that dig deep into what it's like. Was like to be black in America at that time. And some people
mm-hmm.
could, you know, see that as being more stereotypes. But looking back as an adult, looking at these movies again, I think they're still really powerful and really speak to, you know, what people were dealing with at the time. So let's start with Claudine, which is a movie that I love. And, you know, I've listed it among some of my favorite black romances. And blogged
mm-hmm,
a little bit about
mm-hmm.
it. So why is Claudine important in this context to you?
Well, first, let me tell you something. I saw some of Claudine being filmed. I mean, I grew up on 151st Street and Broadway, and between Broadway and Riverside. And when they show Rupert's apartment, like when they're walking into Rupert's apartment and the two prostitutes are walking out of that building, that building was on my block. So it was so funny because I got Diane Carroll's autograph when they were shooting that movie, and I was like a little kid. So of course, like, I'm like fiending like for a year for Claudine to come out. I had no idea what it was about. All I knew was that I was in love with Diane Carroll, who I knew from Julia, and I got her autograph, and so I wanted to see this movie. I had no idea what it was about, and I will tell you, I watched Claudine again maybe a year or two ago. I was writing an article about the soundtrack, which was done by Gladys Knight and the Pips,
Curtis Mayfield,
produced and written by Curtis Mayfield. Well, Curtis Mayfield wrote it, but Gladys Knight and the Pips sang it.
Yeah, brilliantly.
And it's such a beautiful soundtrack. I mean, I love all. I mean, I guess we could talk more later, but Curtis did some of the best soundtracks of that era. But we could talk about that later as well. but yes, so Claudine is like, anybody who grew up in the so-called hood knew families like Claudine. I mean, I knew, you know, people who had loving mothers and they came from these big households or whatever. But you very rarely saw these kind of family movies. And, you know, I guess some people could say, well, you know, she was on welfare and all the kids were, you know, some of the kids were not that good. You know, they might have been a little bad, but there was a certain tenderness about the film and a certain togetherness about the film as well. You know, when you see Roop and how he deals with falling in love with a woman who has six kids, and, you know, two of them are teenagers and they're all giving him lip. I mean, another man might have walked out of that situation. And he dealt with it. He, you know, tried to work with the kids or whatever. There was a certain point when he wanted to give up, and he didn't. And, you know, when you see that scene at the end with just all of them, like, loving each other and walking down the street, it's a nice feeling. I love that movie.
I love that movie, too. It's funny because, you know, there's something in it for everyone to relate to, and it really did address social issues at the time. You get to see Harlem in the 1970s. It's a story about black love and how difficult that is. So people can say, hey, this is slave culture, you know, writ large, where families are being fractured and the system is still actively trying to keep black men and women apart through all of the, you know, you can't have a partner, contribute to your household, you're going to lose your welfare, it's welfare or struggle, you know, welfare or love, you can't have both. Then it had teen pregnancy. And then in the Lawrence Hilton Jacobs character, you see kind of like the rise of young black activism, you know, sticking it to the man, going against the establishment. And he makes a decision not to have children, which was a conversation that was starting to happen at that time. I remember it. And so Claudine very rightfully says, hey, you're playing into the man's hands by doing this to yourself. So a lot of issues did get addressed, but it's still a beautiful film. And I heard that Diane Carroll was not initially considered for the role because they thought she was too smooth, too bougie, too pretty. And she was raised in Harlem, as I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she was.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the movie initially was supposed to star Diane Sands and Moses Gunn. And Diane Sands, she had cancer, and I believe she might have been one of the producers, and she was the one that chose Diane Carroll. So she chose Diane Carroll. I don't know how James Earl Jones came to replace Moses Gunn. I don't know how that all worked out. But as much as I love Moses Gunn, I'm glad James Earl Jones played that part.
Yeah, he's a phenomenal actor. And I feel like he brought something a little different to the part, because he does his like quiet rage thing so well, you know, and you see his frustration and you see, I mean, he bails on the relationship at a certain point, but you know, he comes back because, you know, Diane Carroll's all that. Yeah.
Well, you know, one thing too that we should maybe talk about for a second was, you know, James Earl Jones played the garbage man, and the guy who was his partner on the garbage truck was a brother who actually passed away pretty early, named Adam Wade. And Adam Wade was the first black game show host. I can't remember what game show he hosted, but he was the first black game show host.
Oh, that is a wonderful bit of trivia. See, that's why you're on this show, Words on Flicks, to give us these details. But it's important for us to understand that people don't, you know, they have careers. People were showing up in movies and built careers on these appearances. They were stage actors a lot of times, regional stage actors, and, you know, doing whatever they could. And sometimes when I look back at these movies, you know, like we were talking about the Warriors the other day, and you're like looking back and you're like, oh, there's so-and-so.
There's so-and-so
in this early, early movie that when I first saw it, I didn't know who they were. But since then, they've created this whole, you know, major career based on their talents. So maybe we can loop back to talk about Curtis Mayfield, because that is important. But I also wanted to talk about Five on the Black Hand Side, which I just saw for the first time this week. I'd always heard it talked about, but I had never actually seen it. I loved this movie. I wasn't sure what it was going to be about, like, because the title just seems like, okay, hand slapping jive. Maybe it's going to be a series of, you know, comic setups, and it's going to be shucking and jive. I didn't know what it was going to be, you know, but I really loved the story. And I think what resonated most for me is the idea of the wife of this very straight-laced barber who's a local barber. He has his own business. He's almost in a way like a 19th century father with the, you know, the handlebar mustache and the waistcoat, and he wants his family to represent and be upwardly mobile and conservative, and he's, you know, laying down the law to his family. He's not into, you know, black power, Africanism, or having a wife who has any sort of agency. And that's the part of the film that I related to most, the wife who has been subject to her husband's edicts all this time. She has to account for her hours during the day. She has to ask him when to eat, when to you know, take a walk. And finally she says, you know, I've had enough. I have a list of demands, and you're going to fulfill them or there's going to be hell to pay. But that's just one of the stories in the film. Tell me what you recognize about it.
Well, you know, one of the things that I loved about the film, and I haven't seen the film for a couple of years, but I saw it when it originally came out, and I've watched it periodically over the years. I love how all these stories kind of connect. With a lot of black films, you don't get an opportunity a lot to see just regular, everyday, working class people dealing with their domestic problems. You know, it's not like a story about, you know, somebody who's going to have a big heist or the last big drug deal. You know, it's about this guy and his family and just, you know, what that entails. You know, him running his barbershop and, you know, the characters that are in the barbershop, which also included the number runner, which everybody who grew up in in the 70s knows the number runner from, you know, in this movie, the number runner is played by the coolest man on the planet, Frankie Crocker. And, you know,
and
just,
Frankie Crocker,
you know,
for those who may not know, Frankie Crocker was the number one DJ, air personality, programmer of WBLS in New York during the 1970s, and he made a major change in how music was programmed during that era. And he is cool and smooth, and he's really good in this film for
right.
his little,
oh, he was,
you know,
good.
Walk on.
He was good. I mean, that's, even when we were talking about the, you know, the mother character and her rebelling against her husband, you know, I'm thinking about her having the support of her best friend, who was played by Jeanette Dubois, who we all know from Good Times as Winona, who I
right.
think was one of my early childhood crushes. You know, and she was just wonderful in that movie. And the movie's filled with people who went on to become bigger stars. I mean, Carl Franklin is in it. You know, he later on became a television actor and then a film director, directing Devil in a Blue Dress. Dick Anthony Williams is in it, who was Pretty Tony in The Mac.
Mm-hmm.
Who else is in it? Glenn
Turman
is in it. Who? I mean, you know, it was just filled with these really good actors, and all of those guys. I mean, I say guys, but all of the cast, from as far as I can tell, a lot of them came out of theater. I mean, I know Five on the Black Hand Side was originally done as a play. Now, whether any of them were originally in the stage production, I don't know. But I know Glenn Turman and Jeanette Dubois, they all come out of black theater. And, you know, when you see this film, I mean, it's just one of those films that, I mean, it's a good movie. You know, not a whole lot happens, but a whole lot happens in these people's lives. So I love that film.
I loved it, and I'm ready to see it again, because even just the scenes in the barbershop and how men talk in the barbershop and what, how they talk to each other and tease each other and the comedy that goes on there. And then you have the women conversely sitting around the kitchen table talking about their issues. So I totally agree with you. It's a gem of a movie. It is of its time. I think today so many movies are the pacing is just whiz bang, cut so fast.
Exactly.
That you don't,
well, American
get to
movies
sit
are
and
like
savor.
That.
Yeah.
I mean, if you know, you and I watch all different kinds of films, and I have, with the exception of certain directors, I've kind of given up on a lot of American movies sometimes, just in terms of, because of how they're told. I mean, even, you know, when you watch an Asian action film or whatever, they try to introduce you to the characters and let you know who these people are before, you know, so you can be invested in them. A lot of times I watch American movies and, you know, there's like 20 people who wrote this one script, and it just feels very cold to me sometimes, you know?
I agree with you there. And, you know, you do have to become invested in the characters to care what happens to them, to care why they're fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you mm-hmm. know, fighting, questing, whatever it is that they want. And so often we're just dropped into the movie and expected to care, and it doesn't work all the time. So,
right.
So yeah, so I agree with you there, but two thumbs up on Five on the Black Hand Side, two
yes,
black
yes.
hands on, you know, the black hand side. So, so
I was also very much, I'm sorry, go
okay,
ahead.
Okay, go ahead. No,
ahead.
You were very
say,
much.
I was also really into film posters from that era, and some of those film posters, because this was like during a time when illustration was still being used a lot for film posters. And if you look up the Five on the Black Hand Side film poster, it's an incredible caricature illustration that was done by Jack Davis, who was one of the original Mad Magazine cartoonists.
Illustrator.
So later
mm-hmm.
on, Jack Davis became you know, he was a big illustrator. He did covers for TV Guide and Time Magazine, and he did movie posters, and he did the Five on the Black Hand Side poster.
Another perfect tidbit from cultural commentator. No, this is seriously important. I love all these details, and this is what makes this all this history and these movies so rich, is that you can stand the context, all of the craft that actually went into it, and how many people were making a living. Well, maybe they weren't making a living, we don't know, but they were contributing to the craft, and we were able to enjoy what they did so many years later. And I think that goes back to your comment about Shaft, like why does Shaft, or not Shaft, but Superfly need to be remade, and how today's generation doesn't necessarily want to look back at a movie from years and years ago. But I think that's the beauty of it, looking back at something that was made during its time period and trying to understand the time and place in which it was made to understand. And I don't know that everybody, maybe only you and I, have the patience to go back and do those kinds of things. So,
well, I think it's also in terms of how these films have been written about or how they're appreciated. You know, you would never think somebody would go back and try to remake Casablanca. You know, nobody's going back to remake Gone with the Wind, for whatever, you know, any of these films that are considered classics. And I think a lot of, you know, the Blaxploitation films that we're talking about here are considered classics. Superfly has been remade twice. I mean, I didn't see the first remake, which was done in 1990, but I remember the soundtrack album, because it was like the theme song, I think, was done by Curtis Mayfield, Lenny Kravitz, and Ice-T. That was as far as I got of that. And then I did watch the remake of Superfly from last year, and it wasn't a bad movie. I just wish they hadn't called it Superfly, because it was in Atlanta. It was like, okay, I get it. You're trying to obviously update this or whatever, but it could have been anybody. It didn't have to be Superfly.
Right. And a lot of people did try to tell me that it was a good movie, and I didn't feel like it was something that I would be interested in, so I missed it. And Shaft, I understand that there's a new Shaft coming later this year that will have...
It looks horrible.
Does it, Samuel L. Jackson again, and the character, the new Shaft is his son in you know, the story? I don't know.
Well, Richard Roundtree, Sammy Jackson, and this kid who plays his son. I saw the trailer last week. It's a comedy, and I was disgusted. Somewhere Gordon Parks is turning over in his grave. Ernest Tiedemann, who created Shaft, is turning over in his grave. This is a grave turner right here.
Okay. Do you want to say anything about the Samuel L. Jackson film from a few years back when they brought it back, and it was Vanessa Williams and
I remember that. I mean, I didn't mind that movie.
Jeffrey Wright was
amazing. Say who?
Jeffrey Wright
was amazing. Oh, Jeffrey Wright and Christian Bale was amazing. Both of them were amazing.
Yeah.
I found it funny that Shaft, as played by Sammy Jackson, didn't have a love interest, because, you know, that was kind of his appeal. I mean, you know, the Shaft was kind of written as, or at least the way it was done on screen, he was kind of like the black private eye who was like the James Bond of the hood. I mean, so not giving him a love interest, to me, that kind of like was kind of whack, but I enjoyed the movie overall. I mean, I loved Jeffrey Wright, and I loved Christian Bale. I mean, they could have just made the movie with those two guys.
Right, Right, I agree, and I'm a big Jeffrey Wright fan. But he seems to disappear, and just he's so good, he disappears into his roles, and he's not a name like you say Sam Jackson, everybody knows. You say Denzel, everybody knows. You say Jeffrey Wright, they're like, who's that again? So you have to kind of explain, you know. But that's what character actors do. I guess he. I wish he was cast in more leads because I think he would be awesome. But maybe the time has passed for him to do that.
He has a movie actually. He's on Westworld, so he has a big part on Westworld, which is on HBO, and he has a movie coming out on HBO that I just saw a trailer for called OG. I find, it's kind of interesting because we were talking about James Earl Jones earlier, and the first time I ever saw Jeffrey Wright was on an episode of Homicide where James Earl Jones plays his father, and it was like the two of them. It was like they were these rich doctors, and this house cleaner had died in the house, and they were trying to, or had been killed in the house, and the cops were trying to figure out who killed this woman, and it was Jeffrey Wright and James Earl Jones, and that was my first time seeing him. I think that might have been before Basquiat. And I knew from watching that, like, I didn't even know his name. I was just watching the movie, like, who is this guy? And so you're right, he hasn't disappointed. I've never seen a part that he's in that I said that he was whack. He puts his all into it.
Absolutely. I could just do a show talking about some of his roles, but we're getting off track, and I want to talk about one of the super favorites from the 1970s era, and that is Cooley High. For those of us who were teenagers ourselves or young people when the film came out, we could relate to being teenagers, even though it was from another era, and just all of the antics, Chicago at that time, the Motown soundtrack. I think it resonates with all of us. And that idea of having your running buddies, your Ace Boon Coons that you run with, and sharing fun, hard times, danger, drinking. And I think the movie is kind of brilliant in showing us those friendships and everything that they go through, what it's like to be a young person at that time.
I mean, I agree. Cooley High, I mean, which was directed by Michael Schwartz, who to me is one of my favorite directors from that era who never gets any props. So Michael Schwartz directed Cooley High, he directed Car Wash, he directed Bingo Long. Later on, he directed Crush Groove. He was just one of my favorite directors of that era. And what he put, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Cooley High was one of his first features, if not the very first feature. And that movie is just so good. I mean, and especially considering that Glenn Turman character wants to become a writer. What was his name? Teach. And
Preach.
These guys are very, smart in school, but when they show them in their neighborhood and the things that they have to go through, whether it's the politics of ducking bullies or embracing bullies or whatever they have to do in terms of talking to girls or even the whole scene where they crash the party and they're slow dancing. I mean, what's not to love about that? I mean, it's just so beautiful. Cooley High was one of those movies that I used to see I used to try to watch it at least once a year. And the guy who wrote Cooley High, who the character, the Glenn Turman character was based on, was Eric Monte. And I'm not sure if you know this because it's so far apart, but What's Happening was created by Eric Monte, and What's Happening was supposed to be the TV version of Cooley High.
I remember
And
that.
But it's nothing like Coolie High. You know, it's like Coolie High light, actually a decade or more after Coolie High actually took place. Because Coolie High, you know, the movie came out in the 70s, but the movie itself takes place in the 60s. I mean, and, you know, it had one of the saddest endings. I mean, I don't know if you can, you know, if we should tell people that it's a spoiler, but, you know, at the end of the movie when they play It's So Hard to Say Goodbye to Yesterday, I mean, it's like, you know, everybody was weeping in the theater, guys, women, everybody. I remember sitting up there and it was like, oh, my God, because, you know, people die in movies all the time, you know, but you never, you don't feel it in the same way. You know, when Freddie dies in Superfly, you don't feel it the same way when my man dies at the end of Coolie High. Like, it's just, it's one of those movies that puts a lump in your throat.
It absolutely does. So two things about the movie, and one that you mentioned, the fact that Preach wants to be a writer, and, you know, he's being ribbed for being smart, but he, you know, he's book smart, but he's street smart too, and that's like the perfect balance, you know, and it is what so many of us nerds who grew up in the hood, we wanted to ascribe to. We wanted to be nerds, but we wanted to be cool at the same time. And Preach was able to bridge that. And his friends wanted him to succeed. They wanted him to succeed. And, you know, there's always a point when we grow up where something happens that really grows us up quick, whatever it is. It breaks our hearts. It breaks our illusions. We learn something we didn't know before, something that happens that really sets us on the path to adulthood. And, you know, some of it isn't pleasant. And I think when his friend is shot and he just decides, you know, I'm going to leave. I'm going to start the life that I've been dreaming about. Now is the time. And I think there's something beautiful and heartbreaking about it at the same time. And I think that's why people feel the lump, because it's also this loss of innocence in a way, even though you can't say that, you know, Preach is in any way innocent, but he is high school going into adulthood finally, you know?
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, when you see that movie and you see him running at the end, it basically it freeze frames on him in motion. You know, we don't know if he's running to an airplane, if he's running to a subway, if he's running to the bus station. He is just going to get out of Chicago and go start his life. And it's so, I mean, it's kind of difficult because we've just watched, you know, him bury his best friend, but at the same time, we're rooting for this guy. Like, we just want him to win. And, you know, I mean, I don't know. I've never seen any movies from that era that I can think of anyway, that kind of held me in the same way. I mean, you know, Chester Himes, we were talking about Chester Himes earlier, he used to call his books, he didn't call his books crime novels, he called them domestic novels. And that's what a lot of these films to me are. They're kind of like domestic films. I mean, you know, not in the sense that they were made stateside, but in the sense that they're about family and friends and community and, you know, the things that we hold dear to ourselves.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that's why it remains a classic and it remains watchable to this day. And just to talk a little bit more in our last kind of 10 minutes here about the loss of innocence and having someone important in your world pass away is Cornbread Earl and Me. And I think this is another film that can be classified as one of those domestic dramas. Again, I had only seen bits and pieces of it, and I just kind of watched, again, like the first hour of it before we talked. And I feel as though here it is, an early depiction of a Black Lives Matter moment that started – you know, so many decades ago.
Right.
And it is a good film, and it's got great performances, again, a great cast. And tell me your impressions of it. I know you've written about this film because it was adapted from a novel as well. So,
well,
what's
actually,
your take
I wrote
on
about
Cornbread?
The novel, and I wrote about the novel in the film in the book that's coming out in August. Now I can't remember the title of the book offhand. Do you have that in front of you?
Is it the Sticking It to the Man?
Yes, Sticking
compilation?
It to the Man.
Is that it? Or is it the Crime Reads? No, it's Sticking It to the Man.
No, Sticking It to the Man. It's Sticking It to the Man. I wrote an essay about Hog Butcher. And Hog Butcher was a novel by a Chicago-based writer named Ronald L. Fair, which was later on adapted and made into Cornbread, Earl, and Me. When I saw the one thing, too, about Cornbread, Earl, and Me is that it stars a very young, he's probably like 10 or 11, Larry Fishburne. And he is the main kid in the movie with Rosalind Cash playing his mother. And he just gives such a great performance. I mean, it's amazing to see the thing that, you know, Larry Fishburne, I can't think of any other actor who was making movies, kid actors who were making movies from that era, who actually grew up to become a respected, actor who's been in, The Matrix and Coppola films, and just, who's still working. You know, we look at Blackish every year. He's the grandfather on Blackish. But anyway, getting back to that movie, that's a heartbreaking film. I mean, I don't think when I saw that film, I was aware of, that an innocent black guy could just get shot by cops like that. I mean, let's say I was a little naive, but when I saw that movie and saw like all the inner workings of these police trying to like not take responsibility for killing this innocent young man, I mean, the whole thing of it is, and I'm not really giving anything away because it's kind of what jumpstarts the movie, but this young man named Cornbread, who is a basketball star, he's getting ready to go to college. And some of these movies is almost sad because you know when a kid is going to go to college, he may not make it to the end, right? And that's kind of like where Cornbread, you're like, he gets killed in the first 20 minutes of the film. And that's basically what the movie is about, is them trying to work through this grief, work through this anger, and the cops at the same time who don't want to take responsibility for what they've done and basically are blaming the community for their mistakes. So that's it. But it's really well done movie. It's very well written movie. And it's another one of those movies that, I saw it when it came out in, I don't even know when now, it's 74, 75 maybe. And it's another movie that if it comes on tomorrow on, BET or whatever, I would stop and look at it. It's a very well-made movie. But reading the book, I didn't realize at the time when I saw the movie that it was based on the book. So it was nice to go back. Sometimes it's nice to go back and read the source material. One of these days, I guess I'll actually read the play that Five on the Black Hand Side was based on. But reading the source material, Hog Butcher, I mean, I had never heard of Ronald L. Fair before that. And he's a brilliant writer. He doesn't write anymore. He actually left the United States and went to Europe and became a painter. So I think Hog Butcher might have been his last book.
It is a heartbreaking film, and just like young Larry Fishburne, as you say, really does give like a really naturalistic performance, because so many kid actors, you know, they've got like that little cutesy thing to them sometimes, but he doesn't. And when his hero, Cornbread, is just gunned down in the street, and he's the one who runs through the entire neighborhood just like sounding the alarm, they killed Cornbread, they killed Cornbread, you're just like, oh my God, you know, it's so painful because you know how much of a hero this young man was to him, and then Rosalind Cash trying to raise him essentially on her own. She's another welfare mother, so you know, some could say, well, that's a stereotypical, you know, blaxploitation trope role, but she really is amazing in it. And the music is by Donald Byrd, and so many of these films have great soundtracks, and I don't know how much we could get into that in the last 5 minutes, but just to go back to Mr. Curtis Mayfield, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it kind of started with, there's a movie that came out called Uptight that's kind of like an early blaxploitation movie. We could talk about that later, but the soundtrack was done by Booker T and the MGs for Stax Records. Stax Records did a lot of the early soundtracks. They did the soundtrack for Sweetback. Stax also did the soundtracks for Shaft. Then Curtis Mayfield, when he was doing the soundtrack for Superfly, was working with a guy who later on founded Casablanca Records, a guy named Neil Bogart. And Curtis told me in an interview that I did with him for Vibe that Neil Bogart was the one who said, you know, let's put this stuff out early and it'll make people want to see the movies. So a soundtrack for Superfly might have come out 2 or 3 months before the movie itself. So by the time the movie came out, if the soundtrack was as brilliant as the Superfly soundtrack was, people knew the soundtrack and they wanted to see the movie. And that kind of, you know, I mean, Isaac Hayes, of course, you know, set it all off with the Shaft soundtrack, which won him an Oscar. Superfly, I don't even think Superfly was eligible for an Oscar because of some weird reason. But, you know, Curtis went on to, like, create beautiful soundtracks for Sparkle, which was sung by Aretha Franklin. Claudine, which we discussed, the soundtrack was done by Gladys Knight. What else? Oh, the Bill Cosby, City Portier movies. He did those soundtracks.
Oh, Let's Do It Again.
Let's Do It Again. And, you know, he did two of those soundtracks. I can't remember what the other one was called. And then the last soundtrack he did was for a movie that he invested in, which actually didn't do well at all, a movie called Short Eyes. And this was about a pedophile who, and Curtis is actually in that movie. The play, the movie was based on a play that had played at the Public, and Curtis invested in it. I mean, I guess it was kind of sad because the one movie that he invested in wound up being a bust. So that kind of, but you know, he produced a lot of really good soundtracks. I mean, and Isaac Hayes as well, because we all know the Superfly. I mean, we all know the Shaft soundtrack, but he, Isaac, if you look him up, he did a couple of soundtracks for Chuck Turner, was one of his movies. Three Hard, I think it was called Three Hard Men, was another one that he did. And, you know, so I know we have very limited time, so I'm going to stop right now.
Well, all of that is brilliant, and what I wanted to say about Curtis and what's so brilliant about his songwriting is that his songs didn't just fill the spaces in the movie, they also propelled the story forward oftentimes, and it's done brilliantly in Claudine and Superfly too, by telling you what the character is thinking, what their situation is, what their motivation is, without the character having to say anything at all. So in that sense, he was really brilliant.
when he talked about Superfly, he said that when he watched Superfly, he felt like it was a 90-minute commercial for cocaine, and he felt like his soundtrack had to counter that, and so that's what his soundtrack was.
Awesome. Well, we're going to leave it right here. You and I, you know, we could talk forever, and you're so full of information, and I know the readers are, I mean, the listener, readers, that's what a writer says. Our listeners are really getting a lot from you this evening, so I want to really thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for coming on and sharing your wisdom and talking to me about this, and like I said, we could do 2-3 more shows about this stuff. So, again, thank
you
for being with
me
on Words on Flicks.
Let me know. This was wonderful. Whenever you need me, you just let me know and I'll be back.
All right. All right, y'all. That was Michael A. Gonzalez, writer, essayist, and fun person to talk to, talking about Blaxploitation. Thanks, you guys, for listening. And I'll see you next week. We'll be talking about probably deconstructing the Oscars, which are on Sunday. So have a great evening. Be blessed. Keep watching. Keep looking out.